Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's HandyLink. You're listening to HandyLink on CJAM 99.1 FM, Windsor, Detroit.
Hello and welcome to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Michaela Poling from the Freeman Sheldon Research Group. So tell me a little bit about the Freeman Sheldon Research Group.
Well, we are a small nonprofit medical research group and charity organization located in the United States in Buchanan, West Virginia, in a small rural village with international reach. We have members spanning the globe from Germany to Guatemala, and we've had contacts from every country imaginable, from Thailand to Australia, many countries in Europe, South America, and of course Canada. We have a small group of dedicated faculty and staff who specialize in Freeman Sheldon syndrome and related conditions, such as Sheldon-Hall syndrome and other related distal osteoglycoses. And these persons work on understanding these conditions as well as to provide functional support, assistance, and advice to families and caregivers and other researchers and medical professionals across the globe.
So, can you tell me a little bit about how the syndrome itself affects a person?
The syndrome itself is understood to have, in 97% of cases, certain mutations that affect the myosin heavy chain in embryonic development. Those mutations have recently been correlated to certain phenotypes or expressions of the way the syndrome affects a person, so that we're beginning to understand the severity. That research was done out in Washington State in the United States at University of Washington, Department of Pediatrics, Division of Medical Genetics. What we work on is understanding what that means for the individual, what kinds of physiological burdens and quality of life issues that presents. So what we are understanding it to mean is that it causes certain changes in the muscles that restrict joint motion, and in the case of the face, that cause a great reduction in the facial muscles' ability to move.
So
we believe that this is probably related to the muscles' inability to properly use energy in the body. But this is still a matter of research investigation. What this corresponds to in the individual's daily life is that simple tasks become very difficult, because if the joint motion is limited, then you're having to use a larger joint to accomplish the same task, because typically these conditions, particularly Freeman-Sheldon syndrome, affect smaller joints worse than larger joints. For example, the hand may have very, very limited use because most of the joints in the fingers and wrist may not even move, or may have such severely limited motion that you have to force objects into the hand in order to have a function of that hand. So instead of being able to use a wrist for a certain motion, you're having to use an elbow to replace the wrist in that motion and the shoulder to replace the elbow. Consequently, by being forced to use larger muscle groups, you're consuming more energy. So we estimate between 10 and 25% greater energy output for the same outcome as what someone who did not have those problems will require. So you have the basic muscle problems of the syndrome creating many other problems related to energy. And that gets into another issue where people often are having to eat very high-calorie diets to maintain body weight and, in some cases, to keep from losing large amounts of weight. And this seems to be a longitudinal problem throughout the individual's life. We also have experienced that many persons with the syndrome have scoliosis, and that can create pulmonary problems because the spine is impinging on the lungs' ability to expand. Also, the muscles in the rib cage, the intercostal muscles, we have found do not tend to work very well, and that creates additional pulmonary or lung functioning problems. Also, the vision can be impaired, and in many cases is. Hearing impairment can occur in many cases, and there's a multitude of symptoms, if you will, related to the experience of having the syndrome that create many logistical burdens for an individual. However, I would like to illustrate the fact that intelligence is not negatively affected by having the syndrome. Anecdotal evidence suggests that most persons with the syndrome, if not all, have higher intellectual function than the general population and higher intellectual function than their siblings who do not have the syndrome and other persons in their family. This issue was brought to light to us by parents of children who had the syndrome and comparing them with their children who did not have the syndrome, and has yet to be fully investigated in research.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this.
Well, thank you very much for having me, sir. It's been a pleasure, and if anyone has additional questions, they can email clinic@fsrgroup.org, or they can visit our website, fsrgroup.org, or find us on Facebook.
Very much. What Michaela mentioned during the interview about the strength and the energy it requires for a person affected with this condition to get done certain tasks, it's very reflective of disability life. A person with a disability may sometimes have to find their own way of doing things, their own methodology, and it takes a lot of strength in some cases, a lot of endurance. There's always a way to accomplish and to achieve. Fact is, a person with a disability, like anyone else in society, can have those hard times when they feel that a task just escapes them. But this is not to say that that's how they really feel about it, pessimistic or afraid of the world. No. Simply, a matter of looking at a situation and saying, for the moment, this seems difficult, but I'm going to come back at it, and I'm going to give it my best shot. I'm going to find that strength. That's what disability life is really all about, mastering your strength. Fact is, a person doesn't really know what they're capable of till they try. And that's very reflective as well of medical science. Fact is, doctors don't know what treatments will work and which ones won't until they make the effort, until they take that step to try to make things that much better for a person with a disability. Truth is, medical science is basically a statistical model. It says this condition can affect a person this way. It can have the following effects, A, B, and C. But the truth of the matter is, it can't factor in the human strength. It can't factor in the resolve of a person to achieve, to make things that much better, that much stronger for them. And it's groups like Michaela's that are pushing forward, making the effort. By their efforts, and yes, even their very existence, they're saying to the world, there's hope. There are people affected by this, but united, we can take steps forward. We can send a message to society that there is a way to make things better. It's difficult to conceive sometimes of what the world would be like if things were made easier for someone affected with any given condition. But once they get that little bit of relief or that little step forward, that little something that makes it easier for them and allows them to achieve all the better, many times they'll question, how is it I ever got through without this? What in the world was I so hesitant, so reluctant to try for? But that's one thing every person with a disability has in common. The need to try. The need to reach their best. It's a human need. Something we all strive for. If you're someone with a story of disability life, write HandyLink 4, HandyLink, and the numeral 4, gmail.com. Always love to hear from you. We'll be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Brain injury is the leading killer and disabler of people under the age of 44 and kills more people under the age of 20 than any other causes combined. Texting or talking on a cell phone while operating a motorized vehicle can lead to serious car crashes, brain injuries, or death. Take the pledge and help put a stop to distracted driving. Go to idontpledge.com to make a pledge to drive only. Never text. Everyone deserves to travel on our roads and communities without the fear of a distracted driver.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Lindy Donnelly, a disabled dancer from Full Radius Dance. So tell me a little bit about your experiences as a dancer with a disability.
Well, my experiences really started with Full Radius Dance as an audience member. I was a fan before my condition began, and so when I was in my rehab portion of the program, they were offering Full Radius Dance Fridays. So I would go. These are open to the public to come and work out with the company for several hours on Fridays, usually for a given month. And so I went every chance I had, and I realized that dance was not something that I couldn't do anymore. It was just in a different form. And I was very fortunate that some auditions came up for an apprenticeship. So I applied, and I was granted that apprenticeship for a year. And after that time frame was over, Mr. Scott invited me to come be a full-time member of Full Radius Dance. And I've been a professional with them ever since. And it's been an amazing journey that the creativity and the approach is so encompassing that it's all about adaptation, that any move that a able-bodied dancer can do, we figure out a way that every dancer, no matter what their condition, can duplicate it as best they can. And it's just very fulfilling for me to get to be able to work with these amazing artists.
So what modifications has your condition led to in the dance?
Well, the first one is the obvious one. We're in chairs and not on 2 feet. And I was a performer, a theater performer, and did a lot of musical theater, so I had done a lot of dancing. And for me, the first adaptation was remembering that movement is timed differently when one is seated as opposed to when one is on 2 feet. For example, one time I had come up with a series of moves, and Douglas asked me to help the able-bodied dancers adapt to it. And as I was doing it, I realized the counts were off, and it took me a moment to realize it's because I don't need an extra 2 counts for my feet because I just do 1 push. So it was about timing, and secondly, it was about learning to use new muscles and translating what had been in feet into arms and what had been into lower body into upper body.
So, in your time with the dance company, is there any one success moment that stands out for you?
Oh, wow. I think that it was probably my first show with the company. We were doing a piece called Thrift, and it was my first time on stage in 10 years. And I was dancing with a young man named Samir, and we had this list that we did. And in rehearsal, sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. Every time was, you know, there's so many factors. You know, where exactly were our chairs positioned? What kind of floor surface were we on? But that first night when we started with our opening pose and we were able to get into that list and we looked at each other, we've got this. And for me, I think that was my first real success moment. But there's been so many because everyone in the company is so supportive of each other. And to take those risks that dancers need to take physically. And there's been countless moments when I cannot do that, what this dancer is doing, or I cannot do it the way this seated dancer is doing. And we work on it, and we adapt the movement until there we go, and then we've got it. And those are the kinds of moments that keep me waking up every morning and running to rehearsal.
So, how does the community respond to the work of Full Radius?
I'm sorry, you buzzed out for just a minute at the beginning of this question.
So, how does the community respond to the work of Full Radius?
The community in Atlanta is so supportive of the arts here, and we have such a diverse community. I have lived in Atlanta all my life, and like I said, I started in the theater community. And even then, there are so many smaller companies, mid-sized companies. But with Full Radius Dance, I think that the response for those who have never seen this, they're not really sure what they're going to see. And for example, they think that it's going to be some kind of thing where the able-bodied dancers are pushing us and we're waving our hands around. I had a friend come and he thought, well, it's weird wheelchair dancing. I mean, what are they going to do? Pop wheelies and steal each other's tires in the middle of the dance? And in that particular show, we did do wheelies and steal each other's tires in the middle of the dance. And I think that the response from the community has just been, after they get over that initial, oh my gosh, not what I was thinking. They just see it as the art it is, and they forget very quickly that some of us are in chairs and some of us are not, that aspect fades away as they just appreciate the amazing choreography that Mr. Scott does. It never ceases to amaze me.
So, if you could send any one message about disability in the arts, what would it be?
I think it would be that we have the same aspirations and dreams and ability, that art is supposed to be about adaptation, that overcoming what seems to be an obstacle and proving that it is not. And for me, this is what Full Radius Dance majorly stands for, is that it's about the art. It's about the dance. Everything else is just in the background, that it opens up your mind, and that's what art is supposed to do. And I think that's what Full Radius Dance does every time we perform, no matter where we are, is we are in the business of opening up minds.
So, what are the next steps for the company?
Well, our next big thing that we're really excited about is we are going to be able to offer our first summer intensive for physically integrated dance, and to start putting out there the Full Radius Dance technique. And it's going to be in June 6th through 9th, 2015, here in Atlanta. And it's going to be for dancers and choreographers and teachers and new movers, all bodies, any level of experience, with or without disability, to come and experience what it is we do and how we approach every dance. Like I said, it's our very first one. It's open to teens over 18 and adults. And we're just really excited about it as a company, is that we're really going to be able to have 3 days just dedicated to exploring with new people what it is we do every day at Full Radius Dance. And so that's our next big thing. We're really excited about it.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
This was another amazing reminder, folks, that a person with a disability is never to be underestimated, especially in an artistic performance. Through previous episodes of the show, I've had the pleasure of speaking to disabilities artists of all walks of life, ranging from an accessible theater in Beijing to our good friend Sean Forbes, a rapper who, even though he can't hear the music, recognizes its impact. He uses his gift to benefit society, not just to inspire them because he's a person with a disability. He does it because it's what he loves to do. I think the same could be said of Lindy. She spoke very intensely, very passionately about the work of Full Radius, that this dance means so very much, not just to her, but to the others involved. The trainers, supporters, people who just stand by them and say, I believe you can achieve. I want you to reach your best. These are the ones who are going to be the most affected. Art is a very subjective thing. The question isn't, what does it mean to someone else? The question is, what does it mean to us? If we can go and see a group of performers who happen to be in wheelchairs, giving a great show, giving a great performance, and it inspires us, is that not just as valid as if a group of able-bodied performers were to do a similar show? The question must always be asked through any walk of life, any art, is whether it affects us. Seeing a performer with a disability up on stage doing their thing, you tend to forget they have a condition. Reason being, that's not what they're thinking about. It's not what you're very likely thinking about. It's just freeing. They're out there doing what they love to do, hoping to reach their audience. And that is what matters the most. If a performer does reach their audience, whether they have a disability or not, if they add to our society culturally, then they've done what they wanted to do. The fact is, disability art comes in every form that able-bodied art comes in. Fact is, it can be music, be theater, which our good friend Steph Craig expressed not too long ago. It can be dance. It can be photography. It can be paintings. It can be just the same as any able-bodied work. It's not to say that either one is better or worse. The adaptations might have to be something minor. Lindy mentioned adjusting the dance count within an able-bodied performance because she was accustomed to doing it one way. But having an understanding of that, having an understanding that there are different ways of accomplishing things, different ways of getting there, builds one of the most fundamental aspects of disability life, one of the most important things that can be learned. Respect and appreciation for the different ways of getting things done, different ways of expression. You have that. You accept that there is diversity in the world. And from there, you build from that foundation that says, I'm going to choose to embrace new ideas, new concepts. That's exactly what Full Radius has done. I'm thrilled to hear that they're expanding their work, bringing it to an even more diverse audience. Once you learn that people with disabilities have something to contribute, that they have strengths and gifts to share, as would anyone else, that's not a lesson that ever goes away. It'll stick with you. Because if you build your life based on the ideals of respect and acceptance and a willingness to embrace new ideas, you just go with that. It's all a question of the foundation. If you're someone who's open to embracing disabilities, culture, and art, you might even learn something about able-bodied art and culture. Just to see how we are, in many ways, not all that different. Come to understand that, it's the first bridge of understanding. Of course, from there comes the need for communication. The need to really ask the questions. Are those with disabilities around me truly being accepted and offered the opportunities they should be? It's fine to have words on paper that legally say a person with a disability should be included, that equality should never be an afterthought. But our ideals must match our actions. The opportunities going forward, what it's all about. People with disabilities are building for the future just as much as anyone else in society. Truth is, we can't underestimate any one person's contribution, whether they have a disability or not. Say, someone sees a disabilities dance performance, and it affects their life, even their attitudes about equality and diversity. And it affects them, and they go on, they raise a family with those ideals. And you're not just likely going to reach one person. But understanding and diversity is about building for the future. The question is, will the future generations, people with disabilities, still be asking the questions, can I be included? Can this be modified? Or will we eventually come to a place where we just do it automatically because inclusion is the right thing? It's something we all deserve. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. You've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.